come there at 3 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon here at the Arkansas Camp 1982 to the 19th presentation in our series so far this year. And this brings us right back to the 6th chapter of the Book of Revelation and the 6th seal. The 6th chapter and the 6th seal, which begins with verse 12. What an interesting combination of sixes. 6th chapter, the 6th trumpets, and the 12th verse in the chapter. And I beheld, and when he had opened the 6th seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every freeman, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, Fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? There is no question about which earthquake is being referred to in this particular chapter in Revelation 6, nor to the dark day, nor to the falling of the stars. Because in the book Great Controversy we have positive confirmation that the great earthquake was in fact the Lisbon earthquake. Let's turn to the reference now, page 304. We read these words. Prophecy not only foretells the manner and object of Christ's coming, but presents tokens by which men are to know when it is near. Said Jesus, there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars. Luke chapter 21 verse 25. The sun shall be darkened and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars of heaven shall fall, and the powers that are in the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Mark 13, 24-26. And now comes a confirming sentence or two which makes quite clear that the earthquake in Revelation chapter 6 is, in fact, the great Lisbon earthquake of 1755. The Revelator thus describes the first of the signs to precede the second advent. There was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, Revelation 6 verse 12. These signs were witnessed before the opening of the 19th century. In fulfillment of this prophecy, there occurred in the year 1755 the most terrible earthquake that has ever been recorded. Though commonly known as the earthquake of Lisbon, it extended to the greater part of Europe, Africa, and America. It was felt in Greenland, in the West Indies, in the island of Madeira, in Norway and Sweden, Great Britain and Ireland. It pervaded an extent of not less than 4 million square miles. In Africa, the shock was almost as severe as in Europe. A great part of Algiers was destroyed, and a short distance from Morocco, a village containing 8,000 or 10,000 inhabitants was swallowed up. A vast wave, that is a tidal wave of course, but a vast wave swept over the coast of Spain and Africa, engulfing cities and causing great destruction. Now, I don't plan, although it's extremely interesting reading, to go on and read the rest of the descriptions given in respect to the Great Lisbon Earthquake. I recommend you do this for your homework, and being a good class, of course, you'll do your homework, won't you? Great Controversy, page 304, page 305, and page 306. Page 304 and 5 covers the Great Earthquake. I would like to notice, however, in fact, we'll probably come back to this when we deal with the seven trumpets, which cover, of course, the great judgments which were levelled against, first of all, pagan Rome, then papal Rome, and finally, Babylon the Great. But there's no question about the fact that departure from God, which is what the great papal system most certainly is, exposes one to the powers of nature completely out of control, which is what an earthquake is, of course. And I'm interested to notice on page 305 that the day on which the great Lisbon earthquake took place was a holy day in Portugal and throughout the Catholic world, and the churches were absolutely crowded with worshippers when the earthquake struck. And I'll read now the words. The earthquake happened on a holy day when the churches and convents were full of people, very few of whom escaped. And that comes from the Encyclopedia Americana, Article Lisbon, note, edition 1831. The terror of the people was beyond description. Nobody wept. It was beyond tears. They ran hither and thither, delirious with horror and astonishment, beating their faces and breasts, crying, "Misericordia, the world's at an end." Mothers forgot their children and ran about loaded with crucified or crucifixed images. Unfortunately, many ran to the churches for protection, but in vain was the sacrament exposed. In vain did the poor creatures embrace the altars. Images, priests and people were buried in one common ruin. It has been estimated 90,000 persons lost their lives on that fatal day. What a slaughter. Very sad picture, to say the very least, but the unpreventable consequence, of course, of the papal system separating people from God's protective care. Now, mind you, of course, this is not the greatest holocaust ever leveled against mankind. What would you say would be the greatest single decimation of humanity ever recorded in human history? Absolutely. It's estimated that possibly more than this present world's entire population died in that one day. Over 2 billion people. Now, Ray Winkle, the Lutheran writer, in his splendid book on the flood, I don't ever recommend, of course, we read books by a Babylonian author, but this is one book which is more of a archaeological study and therefore quite good to read. I've forgotten his estimates now, but he does go through and estimates the lowest possible and the highest possible population at the time of the flood. And I think he goes up to several billion as the highest possibility. Remember, of course, that back before the flood, people lived for almost 1,000 years in many cases. Take Adam, for instance, and Methuselah. And while the antediluvians themselves were given up to all kinds of wickedness and debauchery, we are told in the spirit of prophecy it took almost 2,500 years before the effects of sin were felt by that super race. Due to the fact, of course, that Adam had partaken of the tree of life before his fall. In fact, we live today because of the vitality imparted to humanity through the time that Adam partook of that tree of life. But the possibility is there could have been 100 billion people perish at the time of the flood, which would have, or going to say, of course, that the earth at that time was capable of carrying a vastly greater population than presently is, because there were no vast oceans, no deserts, no great mountain chains, no polar caps, and therefore the earth could probably have supported a population of maybe 1 trillion people, which is an enormous number of people, and done it very comfortably. And so the number of folk who perished back there was indeed very considerable, and their bodies no doubt are helping to supply the oil that runs your cars today. Not a very pleasant thought, is it? Now, the great earthquake was followed by the stars falling from heaven and the sun becoming black as sackcloth of hair, the moon not giving her light, and then the stars falling from heaven. I think we do well now to go back to the 24th chapter of Matthew, where we find these same events predicted, and take a look at the prophecy made by Jesus as a parallel to the 6th chapter of Revelation. I've always found this a very useful comparison to make. Maybe I've been through some of you folk with Matthew 24, but in any case it's always a very enjoyable chapter to review once again. Jesus gave this outline prophecy, and generally speaking, of course, folk don't view the prophecy of Matthew 24 as being an outline prophecy, but that is in fact what it was. Actually, Jesus Christ went through history 3 times, as we'll demonstrate in the next few moments. He gave this prophecy right down toward the end of his earthly sojourn, just prior to his crucifixion. He had completed in Matthew 23 the triumphal entry into Jerusalem on the back of the donkey or the ass. The children cried Hosanna to the King of Israel, to the Prince of David. And then Christ had entered into and left the temple for the very, very last time. He uttered his final woes against the Pharisees. And now in verse 37 of chapter 23, he says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth till you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." It's worth noticing in passing that when Jesus Christ cleansed the temple, what did he say? Must you make my Father's house a house of merchandise? What does he now say about the temple? Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Does this indicate a change of status in that building? Most definitely so. And of course, takes away the support for the commonly held idea that once a church has been dedicated by God, a church organization I'm thinking about here, that is a perpetual commission from God. It is not. When God calls a church or a people or a man to his work, then that church's continued standing with God depends upon its condition. If that church apostatizes, turns the back upon the divine messages, closes its heart against the entreaties of God, eventually God says, I will spew thee, or I spew you out of my mouth, and your house is left unto you desolate. It's interesting to notice, of course, that the rejection of Israel, or the rejection of God by Israel, was progressive. The first section of Israel to reject the message of Christ was the priesthood, which of course is to be expected. Logic says that the priest should be the very first to welcome the messages of mercy, but history shows they're the first to reject it. Now, why is this? Well, if our minds go back to the taking of Paul a prisoner in the city of Jerusalem down toward the end of his earthly ministry, we find that it was the leaders in Jerusalem who persisted in their determination to establish themselves as heads in the church, that is, as heads over other men in the place of God in the church. In other words, it was the ministry or the leaders in Jerusalem who started that wicked thing in the church. And therefore they became the leaders of that thing in the church. And therefore, in the great apostasy, they were the leaders of the apostasy, not the tail in the apostasy. And if the leaders in apostasy, then they had to be, of course, the leaders in rejection of the correction to the apostasy. Doesn't that follow? Obviously it follows all the way through. And so, when God the Father called into his service upon this earth an alternative ministry, and who did God first of all call back at this time as the alternate minister? First, John the Baptist, didn't he? Right. Now, does God call another line of ministry while the existing ministry is still walking with him? Never. God doesn't do that. God is an absolute respecter of principle, and he will never do that. So the very fact that God called John the Baptist, and very shortly after Jesus Christ, 6 months later, he called Jesus Christ to the ministry, because Christ is called of God, as Hebrews the 6th chapter makes very, very plain. It says that no man taketh this honor to himself, but he that is called of God, as was Aaron. And so it goes on to say that in regard to Christ, behold, I made thee this day be a priest after your Melchizedek. So Christ was called of God just as much as John the Baptist was. Now, the call of those two men to the gospel ministry was in itself an announcement of the rejection of the existing ministry, right there and then. But it was not yet the rejection of the temple, because Jesus Christ said after his call, must you make my Father's house a house of merchandise, right? So therefore, the temple was not yet rejected, nor were the people as yet rejected. They were the last to go. And so we find the temple went next when Jesus Christ said in Matthew 23, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Does this not now signify a total and final and eternal separation by God from that temple, and therefore the temple's rejection? Quite. But not yet the people, because Pentecost was to come to them, and only when the people turned their backs upon God's truth at Pentecost did the whole of the economy of Israel pass forever beyond the power of redemption. Let me note with you in the book Christ Object Lessons, page 308. 308 in the book Christ Object Lessons, the comment is being made upon the parable of the wedding garments, and once the second call had gone and been rejected, which it was at Pentecost, then the rejection of the Jewish people had been sealed. Let me now read the passage. Page 308 in the book Christ Object Lessons. The servants were sent out later to say, behold, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen and fatlings are killed, and all things are ready, come unto the marriage. This was the message born to the Jewish nation after the crucifixion of Christ, but the nation that claimed to be God's peculiar people rejected the gospel brought to them in the power of the Holy Spirit. Many did this in the most scornful manner. Others were so exasperated by the offer of salvation, the offer of pardon for rejecting the Lord of glory, that they turned upon the bearers of the message. There was a great persecution, Acts 8 verse 1. Many, both of men and women, were thrust into prison, and some of the Lord's messengers, as Stephen and James, were put to death. Thus the Jewish people, note the word, thus the Jewish people sealed their rejection of God's mercy. So the scriptures make it very plain that first of all, by the action of calling John the Baptist in the place of the Jewish ministry, the ministry was rejected. Secondly, the words of Christ say, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate," which meant, of course, that the temple was rejected. And thirdly, we've just read, thus the Jewish people sealed their rejection of God's mercy. Now, all this, of course, is background to Matthew 24. And in the 24th chapter, it goes on to say, "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See you not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." In the book Great Controversy, page 24 and 25, we read about the construction of that temple as it was at this point of time when those disciples directed the attention of Jesus Christ to those massive blocks of white marble that formed a part of its structure. Great Controversy 24 and 25 now reads, "The disciples had been filled with awe and wonder at Christ's prediction of the overthrow of the temple, and they desired to understand more fully the meaning of his words. Wealth, labor, and architectural skill had for more than 40 years been expended to enhance its splendors. Herod the Great had lavished upon it both Roman wealth and Jewish treasure, and even the emperor of the world had enriched it with his gifts. Massive blocks of white marble of almost fabulous size, forwarded from Rome for this purpose, formed a part of its structure, and to these," that is to these massive blocks of white marble, forming a part of its structure, "the disciples had called the attention of their master, saying, See what manner of stones and what buildings are here. To these words, Jesus made the solemn and startling reply, Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." Matthew 24 and verse 2. There's a very important principle and a very mighty lesson to be learned from the statements of those disciples and the response given by Jesus Christ. Now, first of all, the temple of Jerusalem had been the subject of some embellishment, of some renovation, of some improvements, that is, improvement from the purely material or ungodly point of view, certainly not improvements from the point of view of righteousness. Herod the Great, over a period of 40 years, well, I guess not he alone but others before him, had lavished upon this building both Roman wealth and Jewish treasure. Now, what business did Roman wealth have in designing and embellishing the temple of God? None whatsoever. It further says that massive blocks of white marble of almost fabulous size forwarded from Rome for this purpose formed a part of its structure. Now we ask the question, stones from Rome, what business did they have in the temple of God? None whatsoever. Now the disciples looked upon those stones in that building, thought of the immense expense involved in getting them all the way from Rome to Palestine, and just think, they didn't do it by air freight, did they? They winched them aboard these slow old creaking sailing ships, maybe one stone to a ship, maybe two stones, because they're enormously heavy. They're huge, huge stones, probably 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 tons a piece. And then they slowly sailed those, probably losing some by the way in storms across the Mediterranean. And so they finally got these stones to Jerusalem, hauled them, well, to the coast, I should better say, hauled them overland for quite a distance and slow old ox carts and so forth. It must have taken them years to do it, just to get those stones there. Just think of what it would have cost today in labor charges alone to accomplish that kind of thing. Now the apostles, seeing those tremendous blocks of stone in that building, reasoned with human logic as follows. They said, whoever would think of casting this place down, not the Romans, because after spending all that time and money, would they then turn around and waste their own investment? And what does human logic say? No, they won't. And as for the Jews, would they cast down the pride of their city, the pride of their nation? No way in the world. And who else could do it? After all said and done, who ruled the world? Whose word was law at that point of time? Rome. So the only possible candidates or people who might throw it down was the Romans and the Jews, and the apostles said that they will never do. Never. And this, of course, is a very interesting counterpart of modern Adventist thinking, because when you go to a modern Adventist and talk to him about that movement having come to its end, having sinned away the day of God's grace, then what do they point to as the evidence that God's blessing is still with them? Great hospitals, educational institutions, conference offices, far-flung mission stations, every one of which is the product of human planning in the place of the divine. In other words, the very things which totally disqualify the church from being the church of God are looked upon by the church members as being the evidence of God's favor and presence and of the certainty of their continuation right down to the end. So much for human logic, right? Now, in response to human logic, what did Jesus say? He said, "Verily I say unto you," you can't hear that positive, authoritative voice of the true witness. He is saying, "Verily, truly, certainly, emphatically, I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be cast down. Not one." Those very stones in that building which guaranteed its destruction were in the eyes of those disciples, as I said before, the certainty of its endurance. But that which to them was endurance was in fact certain destruction. And the very Romans, who at enormous expense had brought those stones from Rome, were the ones who tore that place to pieces and left not one stone upon another. Of course, the general, whose name was Titus, did his level best to save the temple. But the infuriated soldiers cast away all respect for his authority. They set fire to the building, and as the gold was melted and ran down from the roof, and down the face of those great stones, trickling into the cracks between the stones, those soldiers, in their greed for gold, tore the place apart to get the gold out, and not one stone was left upon another. Now, the disciples did not doubt the words of Jesus, because they said in verse 3, tell us, when shall these things be? But in their mind, they did not think it would come in their lifetime, but a far, far down the distant future, when Christ was due to come again the second time in the clouds of heaven. Then they thought these things could could foreseeably take place, because they appreciated the fact, of course, that the pattern of history is such that world empires don't last forever. World empires do decay and others take their place. And some future power which might arise could foreseeably take that temple apart stone by stone. And so they said, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? So in their minds, the overthrow of the temple and the second coming of Christ were events to take place at the same point of time. In reply, Jesus began an outline prophecy in which he showed the successive events to take place between his day and his second coming. So let's now outline his words today in diagrammatical form on our board. It starts off in verse 4 and says, and Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. Very good. So what is the first thing that Christ warned them would appear at that time? False Christ and false prophets. Put the words up here on our board, false Christ and false prophets. It's not difficult to prove, of course, that in the very time when the apostles began their ministry after the ascension of Jesus Christ, there were quite a number of false Christs and false prophets which appeared in the church, or in the world of that day, rather, not so much in the church. John spoke about them in 1 John chapter 4, Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, where they describe the presence of these false Christs and false apostles in the land and in the world at that very time. The next prediction was in verse 6, and you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. So are these the wars of the end? No, they're not. Their wars are way back there in the past. Wars that sprang up, first of all, between the Jews and the Romans, and then subsequently, of course, between, well, the next verse covers the next point. So we now find that there were wars and rumors of wars which sprang up, but the end is not yet. And certainly there was much fighting back in those days, shortly after Christ's ascension. Now verse 7, for nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, and pestilences, and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Now the wars of verse 6 are not the wars of verse 7. We'll see in a moment or two that the wars of verse 6 are more or less those in which Jerusalem fell, but the wars in verse 7 are the coming of the 10 barbarian kings against the Roman Empire between 476 and 533 AD. So now we find that there's nation versus nation, which of course are wars on a much wider scale than simply those which brought about the overthrow of Jerusalem. Now we find in verse 9, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. Now we find that the great period of persecution is foretold by Jesus Christ, which of course came to its greatest and most terrible extent during the 1260 years of papal supremacy. Now verse 11, and many false prophets shall arise and deceive many. So once again we have false prophets now, not so much false Christ, but false prophets or false religions, which are to rise up subsequent to this great period of persecution. And certainly during the Dark Ages, because the Roman Catholic system dominated the world, there was not a multiplied number of religions as we have today. Because once the Reformation won human freedom and human rights, then what do we find men exercising? They exercise those rights to generate or to invent every kind of religion you can possibly name, and don't we have them today? There never was a time when so many voices said, we have the truth, follow me. Verse 12, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. Does that sound like the last days? Certainly does. 13, but he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. Here is the patience of the saints, Revelation 14, verse 12. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Let's just complete our diagram then. False Christ and false prophets, then iniquity shall abound, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be. Then those who endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. The gospel to all the world is a witness, and then shall the end come. So where did the prophecy begin? With the here and now of Christ's own day. Where did it end? What did it then cover? It covered the after, right down until the second coming of Jesus Christ himself. Although more strictly speaking, the word end there covers also the ministry of the fifth and the sixth and the seventh angels. Because when the gospel has been preached to all the world, then that end work will follow, and after it again Jesus Christ shall come. That completes Christ's first outline of future events. We now go back to the fall of Jerusalem in verse 15 in the second outline. And we find that in the three outlines altogether, Jesus Christ only goes part way back each time. So verse 15, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth and understandeth, then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray you that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. Now this brings us back to these wars, and this we just put the date here, AD 70, which was the actual fall of Jerusalem. The beleaguering of that city, of course, occupied several years altogether, I understand. And there's quite a deal of information, detailed information given as to what to do, or what they were to have done, when the city was besieged by the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Then we move right on from there to verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no nor ever shall be. Except those days should be shortened, there shall no flesh be saved, but the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. And very obviously, of course, this covers particularly the 1260 years from 538 to 1798, the 1260 years of papal supremacy. But of course, as we said this morning, as we move down toward the end of this period, we do find that the persecution tapers off. Those days were shortened, otherwise no flesh could have been saved. Now, I believe, of course, that the expression "those days were shortened" referred to the changes brought by the mighty Reformation, and but for the gospel which brought the Reformation, no flesh could be saved, and the papal church would have destroyed every vestige of truth from the face of the earth. Now we come to verse 23. Then, if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the desert, goeth forth. Behold, he is in the secret chamber, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east, and shineth even to the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. So just as in the top diagram we find that false Christs and false prophets were foretold, so we find now that false religions are to absolutely multiply and abound during this period of time, and they certainly have. And then finally again down to the final great slaughter, because where the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. So once again this prophecy brings us down to the end. Now for the third time Christ covers some of this ground. Verse 29 says, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Does that sound like Revelation chapter 6? It certainly does. Are they the same events? They certainly are. No question about that. But there's one missing. Which one? What's the first one here? The sun shall be darkened. What's the first one in Revelation 6? The great earthquake, right? So we would then conclude that the great earthquake way back in in 1755 was still back in the persecution period. The persecution hadn't quite quit by that point of time. So now we come then to a point of time just a little bit before 1798, namely 1780, when the great earthquake took place. When the sun was darkened, I meant to say. And then 1833, when the stars fell from heaven. But as we've all agreed, of course, the shaking of the heavens is an event which is yet in the future, and which you can read about, of course, in the book Great Controversy. It's a very thrilling reading, so let's just run across there for a moment and pick up the description of this one will take place at the time when God's people have been delivered and the fearful sixth and seventh plagues are falling. First of all, on page 635 to page 636, we read these words. Great Controversy. With shouts of triumph, jeering and imprecation, throngs of evil men are about to rush upon their prey, when lo, a dense blackness, deeper than the darkness of the night, falls upon the earth. Now, is this a convulsion of nature? Is this a shaking of the powers of heaven? I would think so. Then a rainbow, shining with the glory from the throne of God, spans the heavens and seems to encircle his praying company. And passing on down a little bit, beyond where the saints give a great shout of victory, then says, it is at midnight when God manifests his power for the deliverance of his people. Midnight, remember. The sun appears, shining in his strength. Signs and wonders follow in quick succession. Have you ever seen the sun shining at midnight? Is this a bit of a shake-up? I would think so. A tremendous shake-up. The powers of heaven are being mightily shaken if the sun should appear at midnight, completely around the other side of the earth. You have, yes, but you don't. What about the sun at midnight? That's the opposite story. That's true, but the whole phenomenon will probably progress around the world through a 24-hour period. It says, the wicked look with terror and amazement upon the scene, while the righteous behold with solemn joy the tokens of their deliverance. Everything in nature seems turned out of its course. The streams cease to flow, dark heavy clouds come up and clash against each other. In the midst of the angry heavens is one clear space of indescribable glory, whence comes the voice of God like the sound of many waters saying, "It is done." And then comes the great earthquake. And when this takes place, the firmament seems to open and shut. Comes this great earthquake and the firmament opens and shuts. Now what is the firmament? The air, right? The expanse. In other words, the immediate heavens right above our heads. Now when the heavens seems to open and shut, is that the shaking of the powers of heaven? I would think so. Going further then, the mountains shake like a reed in the wind, and ragged rocks are scattered on every side. There is a roar as of a coming tempest. The sea is lashed into fury. There is heard the shriek of a hurricane, like the voice of demons upon a mission of destruction. The whole world heaves and swells like the waves of the sea. Its surface is breaking up. Its very foundations seem to be giving away. Mountain chains are sinking. Inhabited islands disappear. The seaports that have become like Sodom for wickedness are swallowed up by the angry waters. Babylon the Great has come up in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Great hailstones, everyone about the weight of a talent, are doing their work of destruction. The proudest cities of the earth are laid low. The lordly palaces upon which the world's great men have lavished their wealth in order to glorify themselves are crumbling to ruin before their eyes. Prison walls are rent asunder, and God's people who have been held in bondage for their faith are set free. Now what a fearful convulsion of nature. I'm glad that we can, if faithful, and we will, if faithful, be able to stand there untouched by this holocaust and see 10,000 fall at our side, 1,000 at our side and 10,000 at our right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. Isn't that comforting? Absolutely wonderfully comforting. So then we find that in Matthew 24 and Revelation chapter 6 we have a parallel prophecy which brings to view the same events. Let's go back to Revelation 6 again now to continue our study from this point. Revelation chapter 6. As I said before, of course, we do have the additional mention here of the great earthquake, which is not mentioned back in Matthew chapter 24. But apart from that, the picture is very much the same. But after what I've just read, let's look at verse 14. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together. And what Sister White says, the firmament appears to open and shut, right? And every mountain and island were moved out of their places. That the words in great controversy. Its surface is breaking up. Its very foundations seem to be giving away. Mountain chains are sinking. Inhabited islands disappear. Does that bring about the same language? Quite. And therefore, the last event in these great witnesses in nature is yet to take place. Behind us is the great earthquake, 1755. Behind us is the sun as black as sackcloth of hair, 1780. And the moon that same night became blood. 1833, the stars fell from heaven. But in the meantime, the angels of God have held back the four winds of strife, and the shaking of the powers of heaven is still a future event and will not take place, of course, until we come down to the fifth, sixth, and seventh plagues, when the earth will be taken to pieces at that point of time. Now again, we have plain confirmation in the book Great Controversy that the dark day took place May 19, 1780, and the status on page 306 of the book Great Controversy, where Sister White says, on the 19th of May 1780, this prophecy was fulfilled. That leaves no guesswork, does it? It makes it absolutely plain and clear that that prophecy was fulfilled at that particular point of time. And then there follows, over the next couple of pages, again good homework material for you to read up, various extracts from contemporary writers and observers who saw this darkness for themselves and gave descriptions of what it was like at that point of time. And then we move on to the falling of the stars, and we have the same confirmation of that in this book, Great Controversy. Now I'd like to raise a question at this point, bearing in mind that God is not a destroyer, and that the great Lisbon earthquake was just that, a tremendous destroyer, bearing in mind in turn that the dark day was likewise a cutting off of light, and God doesn't cut off light, and the falling of the stars of course resulted in tens of thousands of meteorites being burnt up in the atmosphere, then obviously God himself did not arbitrarily send these great phenomena upon the earth, right? God didn't do it. And yet we find them all grouped around a certain point of history, and then a long, long gap between that point and the present time with no more such phenomena, none whatsoever, and no more of them until we come down to the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh plagues. Now, such things have to have a cause, don't they? They're not happen chance, they have to have a cause. So there is a cause for them, which cause does not exist at the present moment, as it did back at that point of time, else, of course, we would see a continuation of these same phenomena. Mind you, there have been milder manifestations. There have been earthquakes and tidal waves, hailstorms, and various localized things, but never an earthquake as extensive as the Lisbon earthquake. Never another dark day. Never another such display of falling stars as there was back at that point of time. And certainly not yet, of course, the shaking of the powers of heaven, which mountain chains disappear. The heavens depart as a scroll, and the very foundation of the earth seem to be shaken up. Well, I'm going to leave the question with you now till next study period.